I'm Alex Halpern, and this is Weed Week. Joining me, as always, is my co-host, Haley Fox.
Hey there, Alex. So for the show this week, we're going to talk about the latest weed industry news, and then we have a super special guest, love and relationship expert and author Dan Savage, who we talk to about a lot of stuff, but including sex and weed, what the legalization movement can learn from the gay movement, and we even get to hear about his most stoned moments.
It's a lot of fun. Yeah. Conversation.
He's delightful. I wish the interview went on for hours, but we have a bit for you guys.
But first, let's talk about you just got back from Denver.
Yes, I went to the motherland of legal weed, which I had not been to Denver or Colorado since I was about 10. So obviously I had to scope out the dispensaries there and kind of see what the weed scene was. And I gotta say, Alex, I was most surprised by the fact that, like, every small town off the freeway had a dispensary. It wasn't that, you know, they were everywhere in the big city or everywhere smelled like weed. It was literally that along any random highway, if there was an off-ramp, there was likely a dispensary. And, I mean, some of these places didn't even have gas stations or motels or any other signs of life but the dispensary. So that was kind of amazing. And we actually stopped at one of those dispensaries to buy some products. And what we ended up getting was one of those medicated, you know, those like salves that you rub on.
Oh, yeah.
That help for, you know, old people and young alike. But this brought up a big issue. So we bought it. We were super stoked about it. And then we realized that we had to fly home to Los Angeles with it. And we weren't quite sure how that would happen. So I don't know, Alex, like, do you know what the rules are for this?
I mean, you're not supposed to do this. But I think Oregon has made it allowed, if you're flying within Oregon, that you can transport it. I'm not sure if Colorado and California have made similar rules. But you're certainly not. You're not supposed to bring it between states because any sort of interstate commerce is not allowed. But at the same time, you know, you go through the same TSA checkpoint, whether you're flying interstate or outer state. So it's hard to, it doesn't seem to be very closely monitored.
Yeah, I was going to say, after this, you know, we obviously weren't going to forfeit our new $50 bottle itself, so we brought it with us. But I did the research, and apparently, you know, it's still, since it's federally legal too, and technically airports are, you know, federal jurisdiction, you're not supposed to have it there. But a story came out this week, actually, in USA Today, where they talked to airport police at LAX and Orange County's John Wayne Airport. And the police were basically like, listen, if TSA finds it in your bag, if it's a small personal amount, you know, you're not smuggling it to sell, and the police get called in, they basically won't charge you with anything. And most likely they give you the opportunity to throw it out somewhere, stash it somewhere, or decide it's worth more than your flight maybe and turn around and leave. So that's kind of the moral of the story, is do it at your own risk. And, you know, if you don't get caught, then you don't get caught.
I suspect that the sort of the trash cans outside TSA checkpoints are just filled with weed. And I have it, also have it on good authority that another good place, if the airport is inconvenient, is typically outside county and sort of courthouses and things like that in the bushes, because lots of people have to go inside and they don't want to bring their weed inside. They don't want to get caught with it. So they stick it in the bushes. It's a good place to look for product. Also outside of Congress, I'm told.
You're told?
Yes, I'm told.
Okay, awesome. So now we know, you kind of know what to do when you fly with weed. It's basically use at your own risk. And there's also been some, you know, problematic news in the industry this week with some stuff going on in Washington. So, Alex, can you tell us kind of about how this whole malfunction happened?
So Washington State is having problems with its track and trace system. So basically, most of the legal states, and California isn't set up yet, but it's presumably going to have one eventually, have systems to track product from when it's a little seed, or they call it seed to sale, but most of these things come from clones, and they track it through the growth and then through the factories if it's being manufactured into vaping oil or edibles or a salve, and then to the dispensary. And Washington's system, I think they are changing the provider of the software, and they've been having all sorts of problems. Products has to be relabeled, and some stores just aren't receiving what they're supposed to. And there have been product shortages throughout the state. That seems to be an ongoing problem. Is that?
Yeah, it looks like the state had said that they were getting a handle on their end, but you know, it's still a bunch of other types of third-party software and tracking systems that it sounds like it's ongoing. So we'll see when that works itself out.
Okay. So in Washington, you may not be able to get legal weed, but there's another story we wanted to quickly bring up, which is that some entrepreneurial Girl Scouts, Girl Scout cookie season, and some entrepreneurial Girl Scouts set up shop outside of a dispensary called Urban Leaf in San Diego. And a 9-year-old sold 300 boxes of cookies in 6 hours.
Yeah, this is like my favorite. I mean, we got to take a minute because this is one of my favorite stories ever. It's come up for the last few years. I feel like almost every year there's a story about Girl Scouts selling cookies in front of a dispensary, and it leads to a ton of stoner jokes, and it's hilarious. But I mean, it really is brilliant. I mean, 300 boxes in 6 hours is a lot. The dispensary in this instance loved it. They actually posted a picture of the girl outside and encouraged people to come in and buy cookies while they buy their weed, which, as many of you may know, Girl Scout cookies is a very famous, beloved strain of weed. So it's a match made in like marketing heaven. And the internet loved it. They called the girl all sorts of wonderful things, including, you know, one smart cookie. And we obviously love it because I'm still talking about it. But the Girl Scouts organization were not big fans, in fact, and said that she may have violated some Girl Scout rule by selling cookies on commercial property. And anyways, I mean, to them, we say maybe just lighten up, because this is a delightful story that everyone can get on board with.
All right. So, our guest today is Dan Savage, the sex advice columnist and podcaster, New York Times bestselling author, liberal activist, and cannabis user. On his podcast, Dan commonly recommends weed as a way to improve your sex life, and that's just one of the things we got to ask him about. So here's our conversation.
Hi, we're here with Dan Savage.
Hey.
Towards the end of this, we're going to get to your new podcast and some of your more recent stuff. But obviously, we're here to talk about weed. So I had read an interview with you where you mentioned, you know, you didn't actually try it until you were in your 30s. So I'm wondering kind of why the big life change as an adult, and kind of how you think your relationship may be different with it since you started a little bit later than a lot of people.
A lot later. I was 36 years old, and you know, when I was
36,
a kid,
okay,
I had terrible asthma, and it was pre-inhaler, so if you had an asthma attack, you wound up turning blue and going to the hospital, and like doing anything to my lungs felt risky. And also I was like a little effeminate, faggy, gay musical theater kid in high school. And it just like pot wasn't part of the culture. It was, you know, pot was for stoners and for jocks to sneak, and it wasn't for the musical theater kids to do. And so I just never got in the habit. I just never tried it. It's funny because in college I tried cocaine and acid, but I never got around to pot. But it was my 30s. You know, I had a really good friend who was a stoner, and he convinced me to give it a try. And it's funny. His name is Dave Schmader. Actually, he wrote a book about weed. And it's funny that the first time I tried it, I passed out. I fainted. I got high and fell in his kitchen.
Did you hurt yourself? Did you hit the floor?
I did hit the floor. I didn't hurt myself, thank God. Didn't bash my brains out. The pot did that for me.
And it obviously wasn't then too much of a deterrent for you to continue using it.
No, I kind of accidentally got way too high with Dave another time. because we popped some popcorn and some marijuana, THC enhanced olive oil, and we didn't realize how high that would get us until we were 8 blocks away from this apartment, and it was a real adventure to get back. But I'm afraid to answer your question, like, how did it affect me coming to it late in life? I have a really low tolerance, obviously, and yeah, I don't know. Like, it came along in my life when I really, really needed it. You know, I can't drink alcohol to relax because I get migraines. But I'll like trip down my ailments memory lane here, and I don't really like alcohol that much, although I will drink it. And then along comes pot, and I'm one of those people. I'm an insomniac. My brain is always going a million miles an hour. I sometimes can't sleep because I can't stop obsessing about something. And along comes pot, and pot says, "Go to sleep, Dan. Let me help." And it was just what I needed.
I was just going to say, it's just so perfect because literally everything you mentioned are like the number one reasons that people end up going back to weed now. And so it's, you know, it's really interesting. It's obviously hitting all those same spots for you.
Also, you know, when I was 36, I was already a parent. I already had a kid. And weed made me a better parent because I could, if I was high, sit and play Legos on the floor on a rainy day with our only child for 6 hours. If I wasn't high, I couldn't do that. And sometimes, you know, one of us needed to do that, play cars on the floor for hours and hours and hours. And, you know, if you're an adult, you really can't do that unless you're really fucking stoned.
So obviously weed complements sex pretty well. I always think of the scene in Annie Hall where he talks about how he's annoyed that she –
She has to smoke
to have sex. Do you see any limits to the, you know, well-known sort of friendship between sex and weed?
Of course there are limits. I've certainly been too stoned to function and far too stoned to fuck. You know, fucking is a function. I've been too stoned to function. But sometimes weed really puts you in the moment in a way that's necessary. And for some people in the same way weed helps me sleep, it can help them fuck. Instead of the one or two glasses of Chardonnay or Chablis, have a couple of puffs and disinhibit and relax. And, you know, the culture, the way it's going right now around stigmatizing use of any mood-altering substance before sex, yeah, we should all, you know, you shouldn't hit on or have sex with somebody who's incapacitated or blacked out. Or so drunk, or so fucked up on any drug that their consent isn't meaningful. But it's certainly part of our culture, our sex-negative culture, that a lot of people need to take the edge off before they can relax enough to take their fucking pants off. And you see that a lot. I don't recommend getting high and doing, I like to call them varsity-level sex acts. You don't want to be doing, you know, fist-fucking or suspension bondage or sounding or anything crazy when you're high. But if you can get high and with your lover in bed and relax, and suddenly the stakes don't seem so high, and maybe you're going to have sex and maybe you're not, but you're going to be very present with each other and enjoy each other as physical objects and feel intimate and connected, and then maybe you're going to get turned on and do it, I think that's lovely. I think it helps a lot of people bridge the intimacy gap.
And what do you think, I've seen you write about this before also, but what do you recommend to, let's say, you know, some starter who's dipping their toe in the water of trying to get stoned and have sex? Do you recommend, like, what's your routine? Like, do you recommend edibles? Do you recommend trying the weed lube or bath bombs? Or what's, you know, what do you tell people to start with?
Well, there are great weed lubes out there, like Velvet Swing, made by a friend of mine. I'm sorry, I shouldn't plug, but I've actually used it. It's the only weed lube I've used. And it's good. But I recommend edibles from a state with a legal market where you can buy edibles that have exact dosages. You know, you can go to the store here, like 3 blocks from my house in Seattle, and buy weed candies, with each candy having 5 milligrams, and you know exactly how high you're going to get. It's sort of taken the mystery out of edibles, because edibles was what I did for a very long time, and we would make our own, and you wouldn't know how high a cookie was going to get you until you ate that cookie. And with the commercial market, now you know exactly how high an edible is going to get you, and 5 milligrams isn't going to disable anyone. And sometimes the problem, you know, two people who want to have sex sharing a joint, one person may end up much higher than the other person. because they inhaled longer or held it in longer or pulled it in deeper or got like one extra puff, which sometimes is makes all the difference. But if you each take a lozenge or a gummy that has the exact same amount, you're going to be roughly exactly as high as each other and not accidentally overdose, not in the sense of overdosing and dying, but taking too big a dose of marijuana to then do whatever creative or sexual or pleasurable thing you wanted to do when you were high. We've all been there, right? We've all been like so high, we're just staring at the ceiling, laying in bed, and not doing anything else in that bed.
You know, people involved in weed are always talking about the stigma. And I mean, have you experienced this at all, especially in your sort of capacity as a public intellectual?
Thank you for that. That's kind of rounding me
up.
No,
I think it's a fair term.
I haven't ever received any pushback, no. And, you know, I know a lot of people in the media. I was really amused when we got legal marijuana and legal marijuana shops in Washington and Colorado, and people I know to be stoners pretending that they've never heard of this marijuana thing. And isn't it remarkable that we're interviewing people who are stoned and, oh my gosh, golly, marijuana, ladies and gentlemen, is coming to America. And I just thought that was hilarious. Like there just isn't a stigma attached to it, particularly in a place like Seattle. It's funny how the people here led, you know, the first campaign to unwind our insane marijuana laws was a ballot initiative in the city of Seattle to make pot law enforcement legally the lowest law enforcement priority for the Seattle Police Department, so that they're arresting more people for pot than for jaywalking. The police were breaking the law, and they had an enforcement mechanism. And everyone in the political establishment came out against this ballot measure, and it passed overwhelmingly. And then you saw that happen again with medical marijuana. You saw that happen when legal recreational weed went on the ballot here. Everyone in the political establishment came out against voting to legalize weed, and nearly 70% of the citizens of Washington state voted to legalize weed. So, you know, being publicly identified as a stoner in Seattle is to be a part of the vast majority of people in this city who use and enjoy pot recreationally and responsibly. So no stigma whatsoever.
And I just, we wanted to go back to some of the relationship advice, obviously, for a minute. You know, talking about using weed and sex, how would you recommend that people have that conversation as a couple, especially if someone is either more hesitant to do it or another partner might feel insecure that, you know, their boyfriend, girlfriend, partner has to use weed to have sex? Like, how would you encourage them to have that conversation about it?
Golly, you know, if you want to introduce weed to your sex life, just bring it up. Don't, you know, people often hesitate to, whether it's weed or whatever else they want to do or try in the sack, they're also often really hesitant to throw it out there for fear of being rejected. And I think people should, you know, not rush it, run at rejection, but embrace it when it comes, because it lets you know whether this is the right person for you to be with. And the sooner you figure that out, the better. You know, if you don't figure out that this is the wrong person to be with until you've been together 10 years and you have two kids, you're fucked. You want to figure that out before you get married and scramble your DNA together. So just put it on the table and see how your partner reacts. And if they have an irrational reaction that's based on a lot of stereotypes about pot or drug war horseshit that may have been pounded into their heads, reason with them. Send them to normal. Put books in front of them. You know, if there are people in their lives who use pot that they are not aware use pot, ask those people if they will come out to your partner as a responsible pot user. You know, one of the people that I know personally, and is a friend of mine and my husband's, is one of the top surgeons in Washington State at the top hospital, the head of surgery, and a complete daily stoner since age 12. So he's fine. And, you know, individual results may vary, and people probably shouldn't start smoking weed in their adolescence. There are studies that show that isn't good for cognitive development, but obviously my friend's brain was big enough to compensate for whatever damage he did when he was 12. And it can help to like meet those people and then relax. And then if your partner's worried about, you know, baby steps, whatever it is you're talking about sexually, if your partner's worried about being out of control if they're high for the first time, or not sure they're going to want to have sex the first, you know, while they're high, or they're not sure they're going to be comfortable having sex, and they worry that if they get high and have sex, something will happen that leaves them when they sober up or during feeling traumatized, just get high and don't fucking have sex. If you want to get high and have sex with your partner and your partner's nervous, take the sex out of the equation. Those are two powerful things, pot, drugs, and sex. And if your partner's nervous about mixing those two together, unmix them at first. Let's go out, go to the park and take a blanket and a bottle of wine and some food and get high there. We're not going to fuck in the park and like see what it feels like. And we can cuddle in the park and we can be intimate and touch in the park, but we're not going to fuck. So sex is off the table. And then that might help your partner get more comfortable, maybe two or three times down the road, getting high with you and feeling safe with you. And then fucking your goddamn brains out once they're high.
Baby steps. Okay. Like baby steps.
But so the one sort of harm that I think about that maybe legalization may be bringing is sort of in the way that we it's too early to know yet, but in a way that like smartphones have sort of changed our brain processes in various ways, I think. And is this something, as a guy who makes his living on his emotional intelligence, and you've been in a legal state for a while, have you seen this at all? Do you have any concerns about how it may be changing the way people think and interact?
I don't, because everybody here was smoking and eating plenty of pot before the legal market came along. So it isn't as if pot has been introduced to a pristine environment where no one ever got stoned in their life before. It'd be really hard to tell the difference. We don't have a control group, and we can't really run that experiment. People here seem no less productive, no less articulate. The staff at The Stranger, the paper, my home paper in Seattle, everyone always was a stoner. If anything, particularly, again, a lot of us on staff prefer edibles. Particularly, again, with edibles, people are less likely to get higher than they wanted to a lot of the time when they wanted to get high with legal edibles. So I think there may be less of an impact, but my God, everywhere you go in this town now, you can smell the weed. And that's wonderful. Like, I didn't start smoking pot until my 30s. It's not like I was a lifelong smoker, but when I first started smoking pot and eating pot, and I smoked some on and off, you would smoke pot on your back porch and be nervous. Like, worst case scenario disorder, not that the police were particularly arresting middle-aged white people for smoking pot. The war on drugs and war on pot was a racist targeting of brown people, particularly young brown men, black men. But you would be nervous. And then the law passes that says the police can't arrest you. And you're like, oh, well, I guess I can smoke pot outside. And then it's legalized. And sometimes you got to remember what it was like. It's almost like being gay and married. Like, sometimes you got to remember what it was like before you could be married. And it wasn't that long ago that you couldn't, 2015. But you acclimate so quickly to justice and fairness that you forget. It can seem very strange to try to throw yourself back into a time when this wasn't allowed.
There's a sort of shared history between the legalization movement and the gay rights movement. I mean, how would you compare them? And I mean, have you heard a lot of people in the cannabis movement say, I've come out of the green closet? Do you think that's a helpful thing to say?
I do. I spoke at a normal conference a long time ago where I think the theme was coming out of the cannabis closet. And they were explicit about modeling this on gay people coming out of the closet. And I think that's a great metaphor. And in the same way, sometimes people give the gay civil rights movement grief for having the temerity to call it a civil rights movement as if we're equating it to the African-American civil rights movement. And we're not equating it. It is a civil rights movement. That was the civil rights movement. I think coming out of the closet, that metaphor, that image is particularly resonant for gay people and always will be, because it was how we described the experience. And how we understood it and how we talked about it and shared it. But we are, I think, reasonable queer people are willing to share that metaphor with other communities, not just the pot community, in the same way we believe that the civil rights movement can be shared with us without diminishing or taking anything away from the African-American civil rights movement.
And do you think, looking at our kind of current political climate, and especially over the past year or so, how many steps back we've taken in a lot of aspects. And for now, at least, legalization, though, continues to move forward. How do you think those two things kind of reconcile? And do you see, marijuana and legalization just continuing to progress and become more normal?
I do. Just today, the day we talked, a new poll came out that they were talking about on Fox News that showed, I think 59% of the country now supports legalization. And those numbers have been rising rapidly over the last 5 years. So it doesn't help that we're undergoing a cultural backlash. It doesn't help that the person who lost the popular vote by 3 million is sitting in the White House with all of his collusion of fucking cronies. But I don't think this is a movement that can be stopped. I think that even if there's a setback, even if there's a federal crackdown, that will be the last gasp of prohibitionism where pot is concerned.
Do you see lessons in sort of the legalization movement for how Democrats should be agitating in preparation for the midterms?
Well, Democrats should embrace marijuana decriminalization and make it part of their national platform, I believe. And that would do a lot to attract young voters and the majority of voters who support this in just about every state. Can I say one more political thing before we leave weed and politics?
Please, say absolutely. A million.
there was just a big news story about 6 months ago out of the UK where they cleared the records of people who'd been arrested for having gay sex and prosecuted in the teens, 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. And the recognition was that these were people who had convictions on their record, criminal convictions, for something that never should have been a crime in the first place. We have to have a follow-up movement, a concurrent movement, as we push for decriminalization and legalization, to clear the records of people who have criminal convictions for nonviolent marijuana-related crimes. There are people probably still in jails all over this country. There are people in jail for nonviolent marijuana crimes. And as it's legalized, we need to also recognize that it never should have been illegal in the first place. And we need to push for clearing people's records, for expunging these crimes, these convictions from their records, and not turn our backs on people who were prosecuted. Many of them, dealers, people who made it possible for those of us who enjoyed marijuana to get our hands on it, who wound up running afoul of unjust laws and doing time or having convictions on their record that make it hard for them to get apartments or get educations or get good credit. And we have to follow up decriminalization and legalization with having these people's records cleared.
Well, and that's I actually want to ask you one more question then about that, because that's a really good point and something I've been writing about and we've covered on this podcast before. But, as part of California's Prop 64, people do have the chance now to have previous convictions either reduced or expunged completely. But there's a really large lack of awareness. So a lot of those people who are eligible don't know
I understand that people have to request that happen.
You do, yeah. You have to go through paperwork. You oftentimes have to hire an attorney and go to court. It's
it should
really
be automatic.
Prohibitive.
People should. It should be on the state to undo this error and to address this injustice, not on the individuals who experience that injustice. The state should spend the money. The state should, without even people having to ask, go back through the files and clear people's records.
That's exactly what I was getting to. I was going to see what your perspective was on that and how we can actually make that happen for California and then hopefully other states to follow.
Yes.
All right. So tell us about your new podcast, Hot Mic with Dan Savage.
I got lots of podcasts. There's the Savage Lovecast, which is my sex and relationship advice podcast. I'm a featured panelist on Blabbermouth, which is a news and politics podcast hosted by Eli Sanders, who is a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, as I like to say, because it's true. And Hot Mic is a new, not new, two seasons now, podcast I've done for Audible, where we curate and select the best live storytelling about sex and relationships from all over the country, from shows like Body Storytelling, The Risk Show, Don't Tell Mama. There's all these really great storytelling shows, and we listen to them all, and then we take some stories, usually on a theme. You know, we select a few stories that work together from different shows, and I do some commentary wrapped around the stories to, you know, add my two cents. And it's just a little, you know, fun, sexy storytelling show through which you can find other storytelling shows. I hope everybody who listens to Hot Mic also subscribes to Risk, which is a terrific show, Kevin Ellison show. But yeah, that's what Hot Mic is. And it's really fun to do. It's really fun to listen to people tell their stories about sex and then get to weigh in, get to be the voice of God afterwards, letting them know whether they did sex right or wrong.
Okay, and then, yeah, I think we gave you a heads up on this one, but we also like to ask everybody, you know, what their favorite stoner or weed-related, you know, piece of art, pop culture, book, anything is that you kind of keep going back to.
Oh, my God. Something I return to when I'm stoned? God, I'm kind of voracious. I never really return to anything, except maybe, you know, food. I was a fat kid in high school and worked to get that weight off. And now I'm a middle-aged gay man who goes to the gym and like looks askance at carbs. And the only time I can ever sort of eat without inhibition is when I'm stoned. And there's nothing I like better than getting stoned and going for a long walk when I know there's a bakery at the end of that walk. often with a friend. And that's my go-to experience, really. That, you know, hiking, and being stoned, you know, even a real hike through the countryside is wonderful. And being stoned and being in a bakery and eating as much crap as I can shove in my face without hesitation, that's also pretty wonderful. So, but piece of art, I don't know, unless that cupcake is art, there really isn't a piece of art that I return to.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Dan. This was really a lot of fun and really, really interesting as well.
My pleasure. It was a delight talking with you guys.
That was Dan Savage, who, in addition to being a writer, podcaster, advice giver, and activist, also created the It Gets Better Project, which is a movement and series of videos aimed at showing LGBTQ youth that there's light at the end of the tunnel. And if you haven't seen it, you should definitely check it out. It's all online. All right, that's our show for today. As always, let us know what you think and what you're curious about. We would love to answer your questions.
You can email us at hello@weedweek.net, and we will default to protecting your anonymity. You can also find us on Twitter at epfox, like the animal, and Alex Halperin, H-A-L-P-E-R-I-N, or Weedweek News on Twitter and Instagram.
And you can sign up for the Weed Week newsletter if you don't get enough of us by visiting weedweek.net. If you're already a subscriber, thank you very much. And don't forget to give us a rating or comment on iTunes. We're a new show, so we're going to keep repeating this until you do it. Please help us out. Thanks so much for listening.
I'm Alex Hopperin.
I'm Haley Fox.
Our producer is Katie Wong, and Alicia Beyer wrote our theme music. And that's our show. Thanks so much.
See you next week.
Bye.